right. Welcome, everyone, to the final lecture. And you can pat yourselves on the back for being here and having your eyes open. I hope it will be a good and lively lecture and not difficult to stay awake through. My name is Allison Longstaff. I am pastor in Bath, Maine, and it is Friday the 15th?
Saturday.
Honestly. Saturday the 15th. Tomorrow is my sister Marcia's birthday. Happy birthday, Marcia. In Freiburg Camp, second week, last lecture. So I am doing Bathsheba, Mother of Kings. Bathsheba, Mother of Kings. Yesterday I did Rahab, Mother of Kings. Both Bathsheba and Rahab are in the Lord's genealogy and are ancestors of Solomon, King Solomon, and Rahab is an ancestor of David, King David. And again, many kings between them and the birth of the Lord. So there's two different genealogies, and both women are in both of them. One of them traces to Joseph, and one of them traces to Mary. So Bathsheba was the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of Mary and Joseph. And Rahab was the add a couple more greats grandmother of both of them. And those are details we don't often think of. So tell me what you guys remember about the story of Bathsheba. Let's piece it together. Do you know who Bathsheba was? Do you know anything about her story? Okay, let's start somewhere. Who was Bathsheba? Mother of Kings, okay?
Wife of Uriah.
Wife of Uriah, Uriah the Hittite.
Very beautiful.
Very beautiful, yes. Yep, and what happened?
She was bathing in the courtyard.
Well, on her roof. She was bathing on her roof, and that could have been a very private thing. There's even I mean, it wasn't that she was being blatantly obnoxious, but he lived in the castle, which was high, and happened to be walking and happened to oversee. And he didn't turn his eyes away and go, oh, oop, don't want to see that. He enjoyed the view. So anyway, what else happened then?
He decided, King David decided that he had to have her.
That's right. So he sent for her. Anything else?
And he sent her husband to war at the first line so that he would get killed and he could have her. And then the Lord said, all right, because you did this bad thing, David, your firstborn will die.
That's right. And really, like, if you read the deep story, I'm not going to do it all. I'll just sum it up for you. But so David sees her. He covets her. There's one commandment. He steals her. He takes her to his own house and has her, then sends her back home. So he's coveted, stolen, committed adultery. Then he sends for Uriah and says, so how's the battle going? So good to see you. Well, thanks for your report. While you're in town, go see your wife, because he wants him to lie with his wife so the adultery's covered up, because if Bathsheba turns up pregnant, she'd already turned up pregnant. She'd already told him she was pregnant, so it's like, well, quick, get the husband to lie with her, and then they won't know it isn't his. But if he's away at battle and she ends up pregnant, then it's really clear, right? And then David goes to bed, and he wakes up, and he finds out Uriah didn't go down to see his wife. He lay at the courtyard because he was so loyal to his fellows in battle, and they weren't able to lie with their wives, so he wasn't going to do that either, to be in solidarity with his fellows and comrades in war. And David was like, okay, well, and then he invites him over for dinner and tries to get him drunk. He gets him drunk and says, now go home, go to bed. And he still doesn't go home and go to bed. So he couldn't get Uriah to go be husband to Bathsheba in that moment. So then he sends him back to war with a message. He doesn't know what the message is that he's carrying, but Uriah carries the message to the commander that says, put him at the front of the battle and then withdraw so he'll be killed. So then he murders him. So he's coveted, stolen, committed adultery, lied, murdered. Five commandments. And this is sometimes how it goes. When we do one thing wrong, and then another, and another, and then we're in the process of trying to cover it up. And, you know, the lying was the trying to cover up it, and then when that didn't work, then he ends up murdering, you know, instead of just admitting and fessing up. So there's our story. And then when Uriah is dead, he can marry her, and so that sort of solves that problem. But Nathan the prophet knows what's happened and comes and scolds him on behalf of the Lord and says, because of this, your first baby's going to die. So their first baby only lived 7 days. There is a wealth of potential meaning in this. But a way I wanted to dig into this, you know, apart from yesterday's message of there is all kinds of darkness in our backstories and our ancestors' backstories, and we can tend to feel ashamed or tainted by virtue of things people were related to do, let alone things we do. And yet the Lord really does use every part of our story and of the human story to work toward good. So all of these pieces in the genealogy, David, Bathsheba, Rahab, they're all in the Lord's genealogy. They all lead to the birth of the Lord. So that's really an important piece of information for us if we want to pay attention to it. So another thing I found out as I'm researching this is the Jewish nation was a lot like any tight-knit religious group. So they're all related to each other and know each other and are married to an uncle of and daughter of and cousin of. And when we read the Bible, we're like, strange name, strange name. This strange name was father of that strange name. And it's just kind of random strange names. But it's like, if we look at Bathsheba's history, her grandfather was counselor to David. So King David, he was the number one most prized counselor. His name was Ahithophel, and he was as if a man had inquired at the oracle of God, so was all the counsel of Ahithophel. He was the number one counselor to David, and that's Bathsheba's grandfather, so a wise old man who was right in the court of the king and around all the time. And then her father was one of the main warriors, one of the top warriors, one of the number one fighting men in the army. His name was, hang on, Eliam, one of the 37 mighty men of David. And Uriah, who wasn't born Jewish, he was a Hittite, but he had been hanging out with them for so long, and he was practicing Judaism, that it would be like someone who wasn't born Swedenborgian, but married in because Bathsheba was and had been coming to camp for years and years and years and years and years. That would be Uriah. So let's say Jason Greenwood or Jonathan Crowe. Yes, you have a question? Or that you identify as that, okay? So really great guys, but they weren't born in, but they've come in by culture and marriage and love. So that's who Uriah was. So I'm learning slowly the genealogies here because I really wanted to kind of pull up one of our genealogies and say, okay, so Merrily is Ahithophel and Eliam is Don and Phoebe is Bathsheba. But Phoebe's not married to anybody, you know, like, you know what I mean? So it's like, well, so, but Jason would be like Uriah and Don might be Bathsheba, you know, but we don't have two generations above Don to, do you know what I mean? Your father and your grandfather who were also Swedenborgians who everybody knew. I think you have to do that with Wolfendens. But anyway, So Jewish people reading this, especially of the day, would know all these people. It'd be like reading a story about so-and-so Wolfenden, who was the father of so-and-so Wolfenden, who was the father of this beautiful woman who married this great guy, okay? Do you see how the energy changes? It's not just these random people. It's this interconnected community that this happened in. And suddenly we begin to recognize, because we have these things happening in various forms in our interconnected communities.
In your family.
Yep. So then, oh, and Bathsheba's brother was an important figure in the stories. He's just named as, you know, this guy that shows up a couple times, but the Hebrew scholarship knows that this guy named Machir was Bathsheba's brother, and he remained loyal to David and Jonathan when they were being chased and abused by Saul, and he's the one that helped David when he was running from Absalom, when David's son Absalom revolted and tried to take over the kingship and beat David for a while, and Machir showed up and took care of the beat-up army, and that's Bathsheba's brother. You know, and I'm like, oh, it's some dude named Machir, and I don't, unless you know the research, you don't know how interconnected it is, and so it's not some random dude. It's like this familiar face who shows up sometimes when life is hard. So Uriah, it's hard to imagine a more noble and loyal character than that of Uriah. Although a Hittite by nationality, he was obviously at least a second-generation Jew, for his name contains the Iah suffix for Jehovah. And like his father-in-law, Eliam, so we know his father-in-law, Bathsheba's dad, he was one of the mighty men. And not even Joab, who we know is one of the warriors in David's army, wasn't one of the mighty men. So there was like the Navy SEALs in the Israelite army. And so Uriah was one of the Navy SEALs, and Bathsheba's dad was one of the Navy SEALs. Yeah, so he was a really great, important guy. And he asked Joab to see that he dies in battle. And this is someone everyone knew and loved. It would be like a loved leader of the camp really likes Becky Greenwood and sends Jason on a mission that gets him killed. Do you see now how it changes in our cells, in our emotions? And that emotional reaction is where a lot of the truth of the word really lies. We're meant to feel this way. It is a big betrayal. It's not just an ancient story. And yet this is in the Lord's genealogy, and maybe this is how it becomes that one of the ways we can see that the Lord, by taking on a physical body with all of this DNA and ancestral history, really, really took on in a physical way all this energetic strain of betrayal and self-betrayal, because when we commit a sin, we're betraying our own self, our own integrity, our own part of us that knows what's right to do, and we close our eyes and turn our backs on it. So it's a self-betrayal. It's a betrayal of the good in us. And all of that gets passed down. That's part of what this hereditary evil is this mixed up energy that we have to then sort through, full of goodness and darkness. So Bathsheba and David get married, and David had other wives, but they have Solomon first, who goes on to become a very famous king. And Solomon has a unique correspondence. And then they have their next son is named Nathan, after the prophet that scolded David. And Nathan, the prophet who was the one that scolded David, is also the one that told David before he became king that he would become king and anointed him king even while Saul was king. If you remember these pieces of story. So Nathan's been in the story a long time, and he shows up at these key times. So Nathan anoints David. He shows up and scolds David. And then he anoints Solomon king. And then David and Bathsheba have a son named Nathan, after he was born right after Solomon. And one of the genetic lines comes through Solomon and one through Nathan. Let me just check that. So the Matthew genealogy, which traces to Joseph, hang on, through Solomon. So the one to Joseph is through Solomon, and the one to Mary is through Nathan. I'm sure there's correspondence in that, but I can't tell you what it is. There is so much in Swedenborg's writings that give us glimpses of what might be there, but there is so much to know. It's like Swedenborg started to tell us about the stars and named a couple of galaxies and told us a whole lot about them and then died, you know, and said, oh, by the way, there's that one, that one, that one, that one, and there's sort of these little things. And then we're left from these little glimmers to try and figure out the whole thing. But I really do think that there's so much wisdom there that's available to us, and it's okay to just be open to what it might mean by listening to our hearts and looking at connections and looking for these connections in our lives, because our own experiences can tell us a lot about what these things might mean. And there was an importance to tracing a line to Joseph, who genetically wasn't then connected to Jesus, but he was the male patriarch who took care of him. And somehow, because Solomon was king and Nathan wasn't, it shows the royal Davidic line, so the royalty, whereas through Mary, it's more the humanity. And Mary did deliver the body or produce the body that Jesus processed all of our sins with. And so maybe that's why her line doesn't come through Solomon, who was king. It comes through Solomon's younger brother, Nathan. But I don't know. This is all speculation. Let's see. What else do I want to say? There's so much. Yep, said that. So David. When you think of David, what do you think of? First and foremost, good, bad?
Good.
Musician. Psalmist. Dancing. He beat Goliath, yeah. It took an awful lot as a teenager, basically. Like as a flame, he beat Goliath. He wasn't all grown up yet. So a real mixed bag, right. And when did the darkness begin to show up? Because he had a chance to kill Saul and he wouldn't, because Saul was the Lord's anointed. I don't know if you remember that story, and Saul was chasing him all over the place and being so mean to him and trying to kill him.
Was it Bathsheba? Was that the first instance of his darkness?
I wonder. I don't know him well enough. But so it's after he's established king. His life is secure. He's not facing a lot of hardships. He's in charge. He can have anything he wants. He's got all these wives. Maybe he's getting a little bored. You know, and this is kind of how life goes. When we're fighting hardships and we've got a goal and we're really working on stuff, a lot of our inner strengths can show up. But when we get settled and comfortable and things are kind of looking good, that's when we can begin to lose integrity. It's a sense of, oh, I've arrived now, I'm okay. It's almost this salvation by faith alone, you know, well, I've signed up with the right club now, so I don't have to do any work anymore. And it's just a human tendency. It shows up in lots of little ways in us. And you know, when I see it showing up in me, then my job is to notice it, not go, oh, bad, evil, I have that. It's like, oh, there's that again. Like weeding your garden. They'll just keep popping up and you just keep pulling them out when you find them. And so it's one of these tendencies to just want to rest. And rest is good. It's in the commandments. But there's different, there's a healthy rest and there's a going unconscious, I don't want to deal with things rest, which is different. And one of the things George taught us is, like, in the climb to what we see as the pinnacle, what would you guys say was the height of Israel, like their best time? Would it be under the judges? Would it be in the wilderness? Would it be under David, under Solomon with the temple?
Torn between David and Solomon.
Between David and Solomon, any other votes? I'm not going to shame you or make you wrong. All opinions are legitimate. Or even just asking yourself the question. I know for me, I always thought it was Solomon. Solomon was wise and rich, and the whole world came to him, and he built the temple, and he built a palace, and it was just like, this was it. And it wasn't until George Dole pointed out these little details of, you know, David getting everything he needs, and then he gets kind of settled, and he loves the Lord, and he says, I want to build you a temple. And the Lord says, I don't want a temple. And don't build the temple. Your son's going to build the temple. He doesn't say, I want your son to build the temple. He says, your son's going to build the temple, because he knows this is going to happen. And so David doesn't build the temple. And then Solomon comes along and says, I'm building a temple, and he builds it. And he doesn't actually ask the Lord if he wants a temple. And until that point, the priesthood was working with the tabernacle. And the tabernacle was a tent, and they could take it down and move it somewhere else and set it up. And then the people around there could come and get their worship needs met. And then it would be taken down and go somewhere else and set up. And then those people could get their worship needs met. And it was a flexible, soft fabric style of doing religion that moved to people where they were. When you build a temple and set your faith in stone, it stops being flexible and becomes much more about rules and traditions than about meeting people where they are. I had never thought of that before. And then all the people, no matter where they live and how poor they are, have to go to the temple to get their worship needs met, to do their rituals they're commanded to do. It's not coming to them anymore. They're expected to go to it. And it was, you know, Israel's kind of long and skinny, and it's got this whole northern section that's mostly peasants, and it's a little more urban down here, and that's where Jerusalem is, and that's where they put the temple, way down here. And it's not easy country to cross. It's a lot of swamps and trees and not necessarily safe areas, and so pretty much they kind of took a route near the Jordan River. That was the safe way. So you didn't just kind of go there. You'd go on the highway. And there you go. Okay, so Israel's going all the way up here, right, and around here, and Jerusalem is down in here, right there. And they didn't have cars, and a lot of them didn't even have donkeys. They'd go on foot. They'd have to bring the sheep that they were going to offer along on a lead, and it would have to be fed the whole way, and if it died, oh well. So that's where the temple started to have money changers. So it was, you could get there and buy a lamb there or two doves there because you were meant to do these offerings. And if you couldn't bring it with you because you'd have to carry it and feed it and it could die, and it had to be perfect. So if it got injured along the way, well, then it wasn't any good. So like a lot of things, you see how these businesses spring up around locations to provide things people want in these locations. These businesses sprung up in the courtyard of the temple. Change your money because you don't have, you know, it's like the exchange centers in airports. And you can get your lambs and your doves here. And I sell them cheaper and better quality than that guy over there because that's what people do. So this is the culture that started to be in place when the temple was built. And Samaria, so after the split between Israel and Judah, Judah was the ones that ended up telling the story. Northern Israel built their own temple, their own place where people could go to worship that was closer, and it was called Samaria. But they didn't get up telling the story, so they became the bad and wrong ones. It would be like General Church and Convention, but the people who write the history book our general church, and then these convention people are all those sort of dumb, bad, and wrong Israelites. Do you see?
Yes.
And so, you know, it would be someone in the general church who might be, say, really prejudiced against convention, and then go, you know, and a guy fell on the roadside, and he got all beat up, and then this good convention person showed up and was nice to him. And we hear Good Samaritan, and we hear Samaritan, and we think, oh, good, Good Samaritan. But it would be, for me, like, you know, a good Republican, because I'm really, really liberal and not really impressed with a lot of Republicans. Not because they're Republican, but there seems to be a pattern in my mind. So it, like, try to pull up that energetic, you know, he was pulling together two opposites to get people to face that. Just because they're a Republican doesn't mean they're better, they're not as good as you. Because all these people who were Democrats walked by. And then this Republican showed up and was really nice to him and took care of him. In the story of the Good Samaritan, that's the point. So the Samaritans were outcast mainly because they were the other group doing it another way. And they were outside of the control of the temple Jews. It's the human story again and again.
And not forgetting the Samaritan woman was the one that Jesus said, and I who speak to you am he,
yep.
The Messiah.
Yes. Yep. So we have the temple. Solomon builds the temple. As near as we can tell, the Lord doesn't command the temple to be built. But Solomon builds the temple, because that's what we do. We want to set what we know in stone, and it's why it's very hard when we're used to doing worship a certain way for someone to come in and want to do it differently, because that's not our stone. That's not our temple. And to try to learn to keep our ideas of worship flexible and fabric and inclusive of other ways of doing it, to allow ourselves to stay worshiping in a tent and not go, oh, well, they did the Lord's Prayer after the first hymn, so that doesn't feel right, because I always knew. And as someone who's been doing religion for all my life, and I'm 53, and I can watch my habits and my preferences begin to ossify, and notice my emotions starting to be more attached to things and less willing to flex. And I think it's like the correspondence of yoga is keeping ourselves flexible. It's really good for our bodies, and spiritually, correspondentially, it's what we need to be doing in our spirits to stay as open and flexible and strong as we can. So if you run into other people who can't flex to include you, know it's the human pattern of setting things in stone and deciding it's the only right way, and they're not intending it. We tend to build temples. We can choose not to, but we tend to. And unless we do yoga, our bodies will slowly ossify and settle and become more and more in one pattern, and we stop being able to do this and touch our toes. Well, I couldn't. Actually can touch my toes sort of now, when I couldn't most of my childhood. But anyway, you know. So, and is someone who doesn't do yoga evil? No. Is someone who doesn't keep as open and flexible as they might, because there's so many other things to deal with, a bad person? No. But it does make it hard to worship together when we're really set in what feels like worship to us, and we're not willing to be open to how other people worship. And that makes growing churches hard, because we want the visitors to love what we do and not hear what has been meaningful to them, and maybe from time to time include something that has been meaningful to them so they feel at home. That would be true Christian hospitality, but it often doesn't even cross our minds. Lots of stuff there. So even though the writings say almost nothing about Bathsheba, there is so many things we can do from knowing, well, that star's near that star, and that star means this. So maybe this star means this. In the Lord's genealogy, only three of the women are named. Bathsheba shows up as the wife of Uriah. Now, partly that's because they were terrible at remembering women's names, because they didn't matter. But in this case, I think it's correspondential, that part of her importance was that she was the wife of Uriah, a powerful fighting man who was allied to the group and served the group and was terribly betrayed and killed. That's another dynamic that shows up in churches, that when there's a trauma and people want to blame people, I'm sorry, John, often the first people sacrificed are the ones that do not have a long line. I've seen it again and again. Doesn't mean it's going to happen to you, but everybody, watch for the pattern. It shows up. It's maybe not as likely in convention because there's much less of a, we have to name a victim, you know, and a villain, and then blame the villain and run them out of town. There's not nearly as much scapegoating in convention as I've seen in other denominations I've known of. Yes. Just pick, yeah, some random denomination. So Hittite, last year I did a lecture called The Ites. We were talking about the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites and the and my little nephew, they would do family worship, and when they were too little to read, the father would read a little bit and have the child repeat it, and read a little bit and the child repeat it. And it was one of these verses, so, you know, and the Canaanites and the Jebusites and the Hivites, and he went, you know, Canaanites, Ebonites, Hivites, you know, and then he just went, Ites, Ites, Ites. Because it was so much work to say all these different things, and he knew it was going to end in Ites. And that story stuck with me forever. And so all these Ites are different traits in our personalities that we have to work with as we begin to inhabit the land of Canaan. And they're not all bad. So the Hittites are actually one of the good ones. They're descendants from the ancient church. And it's like, Swedenborg says something like, you know, cognitions that are beneficial to natural life, or, you know, like it's, I
call that knowledge.
No, well, still, the way, when I really like thought about it and worked with it, it's like a love for practical, applicable, right here and now truth. What does this mean right here, right now? How can I work with it right here, right now? And there's a real need for that and a place for that. And you know, when you get too much talking heads, it doesn't come down into this, well, yeah, but what does it look like down here? And we need that. We need that energy in the mix. So Bathsheba, as the feminine or the love representative in the dualistic way that the Bible shows up and the way Swedenborg interprets it, would be then a love, someone that really values practical, applied, yes, but what does it mean right here, right now? How do we use this? How do we become better today with these ideas? So that's how I understand Bathsheba, and that can be very attractive. If you get very tired of talking heads, that, yes, but that means this right here, right now, that can be very attractive. And so David sees that, but doesn't go through the right channels to bring that into his life. And what does that mean? Like, I didn't have enough time, and maybe never would have enough time, to understand what the correspondence of that is. That the king of Israel, who's going to represent the Lord, like he, David, represents the Lord. And yet David does these terrible things. And I don't think the Lord does these terrible things, but I think in our approach to having the Lord born in our life, because David isn't actually the birth of the Lord. We're not there yet. We're only about halfway there yet. Still, David represents the Lord in so many ways in the Bible and in the story. What does it mean that David coveted, stole, committed adultery, lied, and murdered to have this be part of his life? I don't know. But it's so meaty. Can you imagine? As we work with Swedenborg and as we grow as a human race and become wiser, I think we'll begin to have more and more insight into what these dynamics are. We're almost out of time, so I'll just talk about adultery and my understanding of the correspondence of adultery. Adultery happens a lot. It happens a lot. You can't not watch. I've been going through a series of Netflix British shows because Netflix is the only thing I afford right now. And it's like every single one of these murder mystery, you know, like the detectives, that it's like everybody's sleeping with everybody else except their partners and sneaking around. And it's always about, like, it's sometimes about money, but it's often about jealousy and stuff like that. And I'm like, wait, it gives the impression that nobody has a faithful, happy marriage. And I don't think that's true. But I also know the world I was raised in, which was like, you know, everybody's happy in their marriage, and everybody has a happy marriage, and it's conjugal, and nobody commits adultery. And if someone does, we figure it out, and we chop them, and we, you know. And that wasn't the reality. It was the story. It was the fairy tale pasted over, because that's the what people wanted it to be. And actually, that's, like, when children begin lying, that's really what's going on. It's not this intentional, I know the truth and I'm scared of the truth, so I am going to make up another story. That it's way faster than that. And it's very much of a, well, what I wish was true was this. So I'll say that. And there's not a choice mechanism. It's way faster. It's a defense mechanism, and it's, I want this to be true, so that's what I'll name. And that really helped me work with my kids to realize that, yeah, okay, they're learning to lie. But it's them trying to psychologically work with reality and how reality didn't go the way they wanted it to, but this is how they wished it would go. And then to help them learn how to name and own the real reality, and in acknowledgement of how they wished it would go. Instead of just going, you lied, you're evil. When they're too, like, they're not even developmentally able to understand the concept. So that's us in lying. And I'm not sure many of us progress much past that unless we really work on our regeneration and self-awareness. But adultery is just when bad things get mixed with good ideas. Or bad ideas get mixed with good loves. Or the worst thing is bad ideas and bad loves, bad desires. And even bad desires, like when I think this, okay, I'm over time, I don't care. 20 of, right?
Bring it to 10
of. Great. I'm gonna use the whole time. You look interested. So we are born love. We're born love. And Swedenborg talks about our ruling love. And it gets into this place of implying that our ruling love is either an evil one or a good one, as if they're two different things. And we're choosing this thing over here or this thing over here. When we're love, we're born love. There is God cannot create anything other than good. And darkness, coldness, is absence of. There is no source of dark. There is no source of cold. They are absence of heat and light. So the stuff we call evil is absence of the Lord's love. And it's not even necessarily our fault. It's almost a default of having beings that are not omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. We get terrified because we don't have control and we don't know who's in control. And if we know who's in control, what we then try to do is control the one who's in control so we feel safe. It takes us a while to learn to trust the one who's in control because we can't be in control. And a whole lot of our dealing with our own existence is this relationship. And I get really impatient for things to be better. When I'm in pain, when I'm scared, when I'm lost, when I don't feel loved, when I don't know how things are going to go, and I'm worried, I'll want to rush stuff. So impatience can show up as rushing for something that I'm not ready to have. And I think that's how good becomes not good. So David maybe was meant to have Bathsheba in his life at some point, but it would have happened in an orderly way, but he rushed it. He said, I want it now, I'm going for it, I don't want to think about the rules. And that's something we do. It's just something we do. It's not even like we're evil and we choose it, and it's never that clear. We get impatient. And when you see a two-year-old doing things that two-year-olds do and they're not the best advised and they're not full of insight and depth, and, you know, it's because they're two. It's the best they can do. And we don't go, oh, you stupid evil being for not having more foresight. And, you know, it's like, well, they're two. They're doing what a two-year-old does. And we love them anyway. And we know they'll grow up. And I think that's how God sees us. We see each other maybe as, you should be more, know more and do better. And maybe that's true, but maybe we really are, most of us, doing the best we can in this moment with what we've got. And God is looking at us going, oh, you're so cute. Oh, oops, well, it's all right, it's covered. You're so adorable. Because from his perspective, we're not even two. We're like an hour old. We've got forever to be working on this. So good and evil mixing are these sweet, adorable two-year-old wanting a toy and grabbing it from another. It's a mixing of good and evil, and yet the two-year-old isn't the source of the evil. The two-year-old's two, acting like a two-year-old. And the impatience and the ignorance produce evil, but the two-year-old's not to blame. Does that make sense or help? And so as we go through life, or as this two-year-old goes through life, this two-year-old was made in a certain form that is pure love. And as this two-year-old grows up, it may turn out to be someone who is like a Curtis Childs, who just loves Swedenborgianism and loves communication and has certain gifts and a certain life, and it gets to show up in this certain way. And it isn't that he hasn't made mistakes or hurt people or been badly hurt, but he's working on this love growing like a plant. And so like your ruling love isn't this all evil thing or this all good thing. It's just this thing. And it has some darkness and some light, like a plant that's got some spots on the leaves and a wound over here. But it's still growing, and the Lord's still taking care of it, and it's still receiving sunlight. So if anybody is afflicted with this, well, I might be going to hell, and then I'm all this evil ruling love, I'm like, well, you're all one. You're all a good love with darknesses that are connected, but they're not yours. And the good love is the Lord's. It's not yours, but you get to be that as much as you're able. And regeneration is the process of becoming aware of, oh, there's a dark spot on this leaf and it's hurting people. And I'm not able to give love that through this part of me the way I'd like to. So I'm going to ask for help to work on cleaning up that dark spot so I can give love that way. Does that help?
Yes.
All right. So that's what I'll say about Bathsheba, mother of kings, of the Lord, and our story, and open the floor to questions or thoughts.
Thank you, Allison. Martha Richardson. My first thought when you started in telling about all these things that David did was that Dave Reinster used to say, what webs we weave when we first try to deceive, and I love that. But what I wanted to say is that I get great strength out of David's story, because no matter what, the Lord always seemed to put him up on a pedestal and really love him. And I think that is shows us that if we do all these bad things, but if we're trying, the Lord still loves us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Dave Keating. If no one has anything spiritual, I have something about translation. I may have misunderstood you, but at some point you said, and Swedenborg said, cognitions of this or that, mm-hmm. as if it was, he wrote in a way that was hard to understand. And I think George Dole has reminded us a few times that Swedenborg used Neo-Latin and wrote in a very simple manner. And it's just the earlier translations that are hard to follow. And they used Latinisms. I'm not a Latin expert, but I'm guessing there's a Latin word called cognitiones.
Right, yes.
And they didn't bother to
translate
often,
it.
Right, right.
Actually translate it.
And in the New Century edition, there is a rule that they try to avoid any Latinisms as possible and make it easy to understand. So.
Yes.
It would depend on the context, I think. It would, if you told me a passage and it was printed, I could tell you.
Is there people here who have read the New Century edition? Okay, and how are you finding it in terms of accessibility and ease to understand? Thumbs up from Trevor. Two thumbs up from Trevor.
Well, Laura, I thought you said you liked it.
I haven't really read it.
I thought you were using Divine Love and Wisdom to teach. Oh, you've used it, yeah. So you can't really say that you're a judge because you haven't read enough.
I've been working with a number of people who've never heard of Swedenborg before and have quickly encountered how very difficult he is to understand, even in the New Century edition. For a lot of people, it doesn't mean for everyone. It depends on how your mind's built and the way you've been what you've been paying attention to all your life. And I grew up Swedenborgian with the green version and stuff, but I really want to be able to talk in a language that everyone can understand. And so I love the New Century edition, and I'm a passionate advocate for the Message version of the writings, which is super simplified and summarized and paraphrased to be like a primer or an early reader for newcomers to Swedenborg. Because the way I've been having to massage Swedenborg into accessible language for my sermons has been deeply appreciated. And that's when I realized, oh, even though people would put up these quotes, they weren't necessarily getting what's really there. So I'm trying to make it more bioavailable. Not that it isn't, but for some people it's even hard to digest in the New Century edition.
Sure, he's complex.
Yes. Oh, our time is up.
If you all want to stay and talk
already.
Yeah. And we'll meet back for discussion in 6 minutes.
11, yeah. One quick remark is that every time I do a sermon, I work on simplifying the language because there is no point in quoting Swedenborg if nobody understands what you're talking about. It's very much where the rubber meets the road, which is what Chuck Blair does, that's what Curtis does, and he leads at Creekside sometimes, so I think it's important that those of us who grew up with Swedenborg be able to give the message to people in plain English so that they understand the message.
Yeah. Yep, I think we all agree. Yep. Thanks so much, everyone.